The Triathlon Show, 345. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Jacob Tipper. This is part two of my interview with Jacob. Remember last week we had part one where we talked in detail about what went on behind the scenes at the Sub 7, Sub 8 project, and in particular in Jacob's team, which Jacob put together to set a blazing fast 3-hour 16 minute bike time, leading Joe Skipper to his sub 7 attempt, and well, successful attempt. Before we get into this part two of the interview with Jacob, which will this time be more general about training and coaching, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka. When Roka got started in 2011, the challenge they set out to solve was to create the world's fastest wetsuit, and the result of that in its current iteration is the Maverick X2 wetsuit, their flagship model. In 2021, they set themselves a different challenge, which was to take the extremely high standards they had set themselves in the creation of the Maverick X2, take its key features and create a very budget-friendly wetsuit that doesn't compromise the high standards and incorporates as much as possible of the key features of the flagship model. The result of that was the Maverick wetsuit, which at $275 is an entry-level option price-wise, but in terms of quality, it plays way higher than the entry-level leagues with top-quality engineering, design, and materials. Classic features such as the arms up technology, patented centerline buoyancy for better and snappier rotation, Yanamoto neoprene, quick-release ankles, and more. You can read all about the Maverick on Roka.com and visit Roka.com/TTS for 20% off your entire Roka order. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 Indoor Swim Trainer is a one-of-a-kind swim bench that helps you improve your technique through an early catch, maximize your propulsion through a more powerful stroke, and stay consistent by doing swim workouts at home even when you can't make it to the pool or to the open water. The Zen8 Swim Trainer is available in the UK, EU, and the US with free shipping in both the UK and US. It is very affordable, similar to a pair of running shoes, and best of all, the investment is risk-free. If you're not in love with the Zen8 Trainer after 2 weeks of using it and their free program, you can send it back and get a full refund. Learn more and get a 20% discount on your swim trainer on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into part two of my interview with Jacob Tipper. All right, so let's discuss, I think we've already transitioned into it a little bit, but specifically generally around coaching and training. So you mentioned your coaching background. Can you talk more about about that a little bit, with all the different modalities within cycling and triathlon, what your coaching has been like in your career so far?
Yeah, so it's been, I think, the freedom of kind of coming into this as a sports scientist as much as just being a cyclist. It does give you that ability to transfer modalities and to have, you know, a fairly good comprehensive understanding of different disciplines and break down how they work. I'm not going to try and coach a downhill mountain biker on how to go down mountain, because that's a little bit beyond me. But, you know, if when the coaches have come from just being a road background, or just a time trial background, or whatever, then it's obviously not as easy to transfer it across the different sports. Whereas when you have that background and understanding, that underpinning from the sports science, then it gives that a bit more freedom to be able to kind of approach different sports and stuff. So yeah, I've worked with a wide variety of cyclocross riders. Hannah Payton, who was an international GB cyclocross rider, was one of the first athletes I worked with. Richard Bussell was a national hill climb champion and time trial champion under the time that I coached him. And then more recently, like Dan Bigham and Ben Healy being the two main ones. And again, two very different types of athletes, and the way that they work and the way that they perform. You know, with Dan, we have this fun problem solving with his hour record and all the different ways we can do it and approach it. And we've got a bit of a group chat where there's like Mehdi Cordy and Johnny Whale, and we just pull out these ideas on, you know, how much quicker can Dan go, and where else can we find these gains, and what else can we do differently. And this is almost our hobby as much as it is anything else. We just have this group chat where we can just like pull out all these any ideas, and we take the mick out of each other if it's a bad idea, and we like celebrate each other if it's a good idea. And yeah, I think that's a really cool way of doing it. I think having other coaches or friends or people involved in the science. And yeah, I think that's like a good way of doing it. You know, you can go and like, you can critique stuff a lot more. You know, I think like we all listen to a few of the podcasts, and if there's someone that we come on that we don't really like, or we didn't agree with it, you know, we can kind of have this good critique of, oh, well, why were they saying that? I didn't agree with that. And it's good to be able to just talk about these things and have those people to help kind of improve my own coaching and like challenge me. And to be honest, I listen to a lot of these podcasts and a lot of these, you know, there's like yourself and Fast Talk and stuff. And to be honest, it's not like I'm not saying I'm like some super coach, and I disagree with what everyone says on there. But as much stuff as there is that I listen and I go, oh, that's interesting, there's also as much stuff that I actually disagree with or I don't like on there. But I think that's really important to hear, because that challenges your thoughts and your beliefs. And then that probably, I almost research something more if it's not what I believe in. If I believe in it, I'm kind of like, oh yeah, I've read enough on that. I know I believe that to be the case as well. I probably do less reading on it. Whereas when someone comes in with a thought or process that, you know, if it's around polarized or pyramidal training, or oh, I think they should be doing this, that, or the other, that's actually when I think, oh, I don't agree with that. And that's when I can kind of go away, research it more and get more of an understanding. And sometimes I still think, yep, I don't agree what they were saying. And other times it's, it kind of can help open my eyes a little bit more. But I think, yeah, definitely being, doing this with mates where you can be more like, have more of a critique and stuff, you know, we'll listen to some of these podcasts and be like, oh, do you hear so-and-so? He was did not agree with that or whatever. I think that's quite a good fun way of doing it. Yeah. And that's kind of how I've helped. Yeah. I think that's kind of how my coaching's kind of gone on to looking at these different things, different disciplines and different ways of doing things, that it's all just this big, really coaching is this big experiment where you've got all these athletes and you're ultimately just constantly trying to work out the best way for that individual athlete to improve. And I think that's one of the really big things, and that it's definitely something that you kind of get with experience, is learning which athletes deal with different things in different ways. And it's, you know, every athlete is ultimately a big science experiment. And, you know, as much as you can have this, you know, the debate with everything now seems to be in sports science is polarized or pyramidal training, and well, how do we define where those different things start, and what, but it's also about what works for different athletes. Like there is still a case of, I've got some athletes that I do not know why they adapt to certain stimulus. Like there's not papers that suggest they do, but they do. And you cannot ignore that. They just love going and doing a certain type of training modality that I don't normally set for everyone else, but they clearly adapt super well to it. You see their numbers go up. You see the training go up. Like, you know, the results go up, everything improves. You're like, I don't know why that's happening, but you've got to roll with it. And you've got to say, like, you know, it's not saying then don't try other stuff, and just, you know, I do, but, I think that's the fun part, is you have this understanding of all these different things that can make an athlete faster, and you work out how to apply them to an athlete and working out the best way to make them go fast, given all the circumstances that they've gotten available. And that's the really important thing, because, you know, the majority of people I coach aren't just, well, even Dan, again, that's probably one of the reasons why I do work well with Dan, is because he's not a normal full-time athlete. He's not got unlimited hours. He's flying off to Andorra or to Switzerland or to, you know, he's now on INEOS camps. And actually that problem solving, it's not what's the best 1 week training you could have 6 weeks out from an hour record. It's the best week's training given what we know about Dan, what he likes, what he doesn't like, what he goes well off, what he doesn't go well off. Given the fact that he's flying here, he's got a wedding there, he's got a meeting at 10 o'clock on that day, what's the best week that we can do for his circumstance? And I mean, and again, he's probably one of the easier ones, because as soon as you throw wife, kids, dog walking into it, that pretty makes things even harder. So again, it's not just what's the best week's training according to some study done with East African runners. It's what's the best, you know, it's what's the best modalities that we can work for someone that has got all these other things going on and can only afford a set amount of time. And there's rules that I'll try and apply. There's things that I know generally work and work for most people. And, you know, like, I don't know, like no one gets high intensities 7 days a week or anything like that. You know, it's still relatively normal, but it's still always about tweaking it and that nuance to making sure it works for individual people. And I think as an individual listening to this, it's also important to remember that for yourself, that, you know, you may have opportunities to do things that work really well for you. You may find that Thursday night chain gang, just, you love it. It's with your mates. It gives you mental freedom to do it and to enjoy it. And you just know, like, you sometimes just know that that is a session that works really well for you. And, you know, that might not be characterized in a single training study. I've not ever really seen the effects of chain gangs on training performance. That's literally, 90% sure. There's not a study on that. But if that works really well for you and you know that works well for you, then you don't need to say, oh, but according to this model or this sports scientist, I shouldn't be doing that. You still have to listen to you and make sure that it's the best that you can, you know, like listen to the science, listen to stuff, but apply that the best you can to your unique circumstances, because you are not the same. You are not necessarily a Norwegian cross country skier that is full time. You are Dave. You live in Scunthorpe. You have 4 days a week to train. Like, that is you. That's all you can do. So you have to work it the best around what works for you, and just apply just a scientific mindset to that of, I apply this stimulus, do I improve, yes or no? And just as long as you're doing that and you're trying to optimize whatever you are doing, then I don't think you can go too far wrong with that.
Yeah, I think you raised many great points there. I think the scientific mindset and thinking about it as an experiment, but obviously then you need to be, as a coach or as an athlete, accountable for actually making sure that you keep track of how you're responding to the training that you're doing, that you know what you have done and know what happened, what result did you get, and then you change the experiment if it didn't work, or you maybe double down on it if it did work. Those are some really great points, and I think you can really, if you want to, you can find science to support any narrative you might have about your training philosophy. So that just goes to show that there's still so limited information about the optimal training program. I had Dr. Philip Larsen on a few weeks ago, and we kind of went down that route a little bit, not necessarily talking about the optimal training program, but looking at things in more detail at the muscular level. But it's way, way, way too early to be able to make any such conclusions from the science that we have. So I think the scientific mindset, and rather than thinking that you will find the answers to your questions in any scientific paper is the way to go. But then obviously you need to be informed by the science that is out there that can help you formulate your experiments more effectively.
Yes, 100%. I mean, like, I've applied, you know, like there's obviously the famous one with, or say, I consider it famous, maybe it's not, but with, you know, where Seiler's done the effects of 4 minute intervals, 8 minute intervals, and 16 minute intervals, and you know, it was like the 8 minute was found to be the best, etc. But that, like, if you look at that, there's outliers in those studies. You know, you look, it's not everyone improved the exact same amount. One person in that study, I haven't got this hand, but in all these training studies, there's always a few people that aren't quite this and are outliers and don't respond the same way that everyone else does. And you do have to account for that and be aware of that. When I've tried to follow some of those, I'm just a different type of, I'm more of a sprint-based athlete. As endurance athletes go, I'm not a sprint-based athlete like Usain Bolt, but as endurance athletes go, I'm more of a sprint-based athlete. I've got like a 1600 watt kind of sprint and stuff. I do not adapt the same way that John Archibald, who is a super slow twitch diesel engine, adapts to training. I mentally and physically cannot do the sessions the same way that he does, or the way that he trains. And you have to take that into account, you know, that a lot of these studies, you know, are based on, you know, like a lot, you know, then it's not, it's, there's, sorry, I'm losing my words here. The people that are in those studies aren't always you. It's not, you know, that study's not been done for you. I think look at the studies on papers that do, you know, that are looking at case studies on what do other athletes do, and try and apply that, try and use that. But if it doesn't work, then try something else, because there are different ways of doing things, and there's different stimuluses that work for different people. And I can't, like, I found as a coach, I cannot apply the same thing to everyone. And I've been there, like in my past, you know, when I was, you know, still kind of coming up, I've been coaching for 10 years, but I'm still only 30. So, you know, it's still been a learning curve as I've been on the way up. And I mean, I'm not at the top now. Any coach is still always learning. Everyone's still always learning. And I've made the mistake of, you know, of going, you know, I don't care that you think this works really well for you. The scientific paper says that this is what you should be doing, and we should be applying this stimulus to you. Or according to Silo, you know, we need to be like knocking that interval session off and just do these two sessions a week instead, because that's loads better for you. And it doesn't work for everyone. Some people it does. Some people go, oh yeah, since I started doing that, game changer. Great. Brilliant. You're obviously one of the same people in this case study, but for other people, it doesn't work. And you have to kind of take that into account, and you have to make sure you are, like I say, you are problem solving and optimizing for that individual person, and seeing what works well for you. And 100%, you use the science, apply the science, see what, you know, have a look at, you know, what intervals maybe work best. You know, like Tabata intervals, like super popular, loads of research on them. Integrate them into your training. Brilliant. They're a fantastic session. But if it doesn't work for you, then you can't just sit there and keep hammering yourself with a certain effort that does not work for you. As much as anything, like, you might just not like the session. Yet, like, you have to take that as a coach. I have to take that into account. If someone says to me, "I hate this session. I dread doing this session." Sometimes I know it's a great session. I know that if they did it and they got it done, that all my other athletes respond really well from it, and I respond well from it. It's great. You know, certain sessions just work, just tick a load of boxes, work really well when they're applied at the right time. Some athletes just don't like them. If they don't like them, you can't just keep hammering. You know, you need happy athletes. You need to be a happy athlete yourself. You can't just be miserable all the time doing stuff that you don't like to do. If you do that, you know, you're just on the road to burnout. So yeah, applying the science in a way that works well for you, that works for you and your specific circumstances.
Yeah, I think that a happy athlete, that's almost like, it's as fundamental as, you know, you do need to sleep to be able to adapt to any stimulus. You do need to eat to adapt to any stimulus. And I think you could argue that the same is true, although I don't think that we can't quite say that with the same scientific rigor, because it's difficult to study that. But I think the same applies, that you do need to be happy overall, at least, not necessarily that every day is sunshine and rainbows, but overall you need to be happy with your training and believe in your training to adapt to the training program.
Yeah, I feel really bad that I've come on the scientific triathlon podcast and that I'm talking about stuff that's not.
Oh,
that
no, this is, don't worry.
And I'm not bringing that, out all my references.
It's that triathlon show. It's not the scientific triathlon.
Oh, sorry. That's why then I'm misinterpreting it. Sorry. That's my dyslexia as well. I'm literally sat here at my desk. I've got like papers sat here. I've got books sat here. Like, I'm into my science. Like, I love this stuff. But from a coaching perspective, you have to understand that there's other things. And you know, like, I had an athlete who won the West Midlands Regional Championships yesterday. Like, I think that's a great event. I've won that before. I'm dead proud of winning the West. I was dead proud when I won the West Midlands Championships. It's not the be all and end all in cycling, but it's, you know, it's cool. In the history of like British cycling, the winner of the regional championships is always a cool little thing to do. And the difference between this year and other years is the guy's just happy at the moment. Like, his team last year didn't make him happy. Like, they kind of gave him equipment that he didn't want to use. They were like just a bit like bullish in the group chat and didn't respect him well or treat him well enough. And the difference between this year and last year is he's just happier. Like, his training's not like a million times better. Like, it's not all perfect. He still misses a few sessions. He still feels tired at times and doesn't always get it done. You know, like, he's not a perfect athlete. No one is. But the biggest difference between this year and last year is he's a lot happier this year through other circumstances and other things. It's not always to do with training. It can be to do with relationships. It can be to do with financial issues. Like, and you know, you can't control that. You can't just say, I'm going to be happier now because like I'm going to just wipe off all my debt and be happy. But you have to factor in that, you know, if you've got life stress and you've got other things, that it's going to be hard to perform. And that's a big part of it, is you need to be trying to like make sure that you're in a circumstance that you are as happy as possible through, you enjoy your sessions, you've got friends to train with, you're doing races that you want to do or you enjoy doing, you're not kind of forcing yourself there. And you'll perform a lot better through that way. You know, like I say, there's only so many things you can control. You can't just control, oh, I'm going to be like really happy in my current relationship or whatever. Like, not everyone has that opportunity. Some people aren't, you know, don't have that. But like, it's a case of, you know, like, if you've got bad stuff going on in your life and stuff's not going well, unfortunately, like, you can use sport as an outlet, but you can't always expect to perform off the back of it. Again, I had an issue last year where I had like a close friend pass, and yeah, but training, racing, just that was it. Yeah, guess what, I did not race well at the end of last year. Like, these things have a stress on you, they place a lot on you, and you have to factor that in when it's not going well, and you have to just try and take control of what the things you can do, when you can enjoy yourself, take advantage of that, enjoy that. And when there is the chance, when there is the opportunity for like almost happiness, choose it. And I think like a lot of athletes almost, again, the same with my athletes, I maybe don't always do the best job of making sure they realize that's what I'm pushing for them. You know, I will have people say, oh, like, actually, am I okay to go mountain biking with my friends on Saturday? I'm like, yeah, of course you are. Like, you know, like, it's not about just like absolutely killing yourself to this super strict training program. Like, is it 100% optimal to go mountain biking rather than do the 4x8-minute efforts? Probably not from a physiological perspective, but in the big picture with everything else that's going on, there's more gains for you, like seeing your friends and enjoying yourself and making sure you're happy on the bike. You'll get more out of it than just optimizing every little last session and stuff. And I just think it's something that I've forgotten as well. It's something that I, like, as an athlete, I learned that as well, that, you know, there were group runs that I should have gone on, I should have trained with friends, I should have trained with, I'd have enjoyed cycling a lot more at times. Instead, I've gone out and I've tried to do intervals and I've tried, you know, I'm doing this, I'm being strict. And you end up then becoming less consistent because just cycling or sport, whatever it is, feels like almost more torturous. And then, you know, you do have days that you wake up and you can't be arsed, you don't want to train, or, you know, you eat like crap because you're not in a good mind space. And you almost realize that I've done this to myself. If I'd have just consistently gone out and done the Tuesday night club run instead, some mates, that might have been enough to just keep me like happy and loving it and still hungry for the sport, rather than trying to always absolutely optimize everything. It's not to say there's not a place for intervals. If you're being coached by me, you can't just go off plan every day of the week to go and be happy and say I'm going to the cinema instead. Like that, you know, you can't. There's a fine balance. I just think as endurance athletes, it's a hard sport, and you have to make sure that there's that level of enjoyment there as well when the option is available.
Yeah, I think you made a good point when we chatted off air about the sub 7 and in relation to that anyway, how Alistair Brownlee and the Leeds Triathlon Centre has now come to be this hub of triathlon in England, where you have some of the best athletes and how they kind of push each other, train with each other, and how. If you mentioned that if you had that sort of group environment when in your earlier days, maybe that would have made a difference in development as well. And how do you think that relates to age groupers and just going out and doing some training with their mates every once in a while, or finding a regular swim group or chain gang or something that just makes you train with others every once in a while and benefit from that group effect?
Yeah, so that kind of to give people a bit of context to that, like the chat offline, like literally all we said was that I got the opportunity early season through Hoob. I was on an investors camp, so I literally spent a week with the Brownlees in the south of Spain, and basically what their group were doing there, and it just really opened my eyes. You know, like, I always have, you know, everyone has massive respect for these guys and these girls. They're training mad hours. They're doing, you know, up early for swims, then doing runs, then bike. You know, like it's a real hard knit training group. There's no messing about there. But it equally made me realize how much easier that is to do when you're with your friends. You know, they would swim in the morning, but they'd have Booker on the side, who's like, you know, not only is he giving them splits, not only is he giving them a good session, not only are they their mates, he's there like getting them pumped. He's there, you know, come on, mate, get in, you know, last effort, last rep. You know, if you're there in a public pool at 6 a.m, knowing that you've got work to come after that, it's not easy. And I think people need to give themselves a break sometimes. These athletes can do these 30-hour weeks, which is massively respectful, but it's definitely easier if you're with a group and a coach that's, you know, almost cheering you on. And they come out of the swim, and then they have a coffee, they have a croissant, you know, just like normal people, they get to enjoy themselves. It's not then racing off to go and pick the kids up. It definitely makes training so much easier. And I spoke to another guy the other day, Max Sapley, who's a really good Australian triathlete, and he just says, yeah, since he's been in Leeds, he doesn't think he's trained by himself once. He's just got really good runners to run with, really good swimmers, cyclists. He just gets trained by himself all the time, and gets trained with, like, with friends all the time. And I rode with him on Saturday, and yeah, like, you always forget that I wasn't really looking at my watch. I just went out and got a good ride in, and yeah, it was absolutely fine. I enjoyed it. And you forget that you can almost torture yourself going out and doing, you know, the super hard efforts by yourself, or going out in the rain, or, you know, like a long, like, I mean, I've done a lot of it. I've done 4 or 5 hour rides by myself, and that's where the podcast came in useful, like listening to podcasts while riding along. And but I think it takes a lot out of you, and you know, and sometimes you fail it. Sometimes you go out and you do an hour, you get an hour in, and it rains, and you go back, and you're like, oh, like I'm mentally weak, I'm soft. I'm meant to be pro, and I've only managed an hour and a half ride. Blah, blah, you know, and you start beating yourself up. You start feeling down about yourself. You just think, if that was with a group of mates, it would be so much easier. And like, okay, that group of mates, you might have ridden 20 watts slower. You might have ridden, but the chances are you'd probably have gone out and you'd have got that ride done, and you'd have enjoyed it, and you'd have felt kind of mentally refreshed from it. Whereas you kind of torture yourself by yourself, and yeah, you might hit your numbers exactly on the dot. You might ride to exactly 210 watts like you're aiming to, whereas you go on the club run and yeah, average is 190, and it's a bit messy. But if you enjoy that so much more, and go and like use that as well. You know, you might have a 4 hour ride to do, so you go, right, I'm going to do 2 hours in the club run, enjoy it, and then I'm going to go and do my own ride after. But that makes it so much easier. And that club run, again, it might be suboptimal, but if you're enjoying yourself, it's what you want to do, and it's you with your mates, I think you can just get so much more from that. And it's just definitely a mistake that I know as an athlete I've made, of just being too harsh, too critical of myself, and not enjoying it enough. And it makes, you know, everyone barks on that consistency. Like, we all know that's super important. We all know that's what you need to do, but it's not easy. Like, people talk about consistency as if it's this really easy thing to do. It's not. It's about also finding ways that make you want to be consistent, having swim groups that are on a Wednesday night at this time, so you've got a target time to go there and know that you're going to, you know, like, I can't tell you how many turbo sessions I've started and not finished. Like, I hate it. I don't enjoy turbo in any way whatsoever. It doesn't matter if I'm on Zwift or whatever it is. I'm just not, for me, that just, I need more mental stimulus than that. I just can't do it. Whereas swimming, which is classed as, you know, people class swimming as boring typically. Like, that is what, how a lot of people describe it. You know, you're just looking at the line down the middle of the lane. But as soon as I'm in there with a group of people, I don't think twice about getting out early. Like, I think I've done once when I had a race or something, but like, if I'm planning on doing the hour and a half or hour swim session, I'll do the full session because you're there with people, with a coach, with a plan. I just think that makes it so much easier. I don't feel like that's a pain in any way, going out and doing these swim sessions when I'm with a group. Whereas I swim by myself in the local leisure centre and it just feels, it's tough. Like, endurance sport is tough. There's no way around it. And these people that have the luxury of having these groups to train with, it's not that they're not tough, but it's definitely easier for them. And I think, you know, you can either try and find a way that facilitates it to be easier for you by having friends, groups, people you train with, or if it's not going well, just don't beat yourself up over it, because it's a hard sport. And pro athletes from triathlon, from cycling, when they're by themselves, they still all fail sessions as well. They don't get everything done. They don't get everything perfectly. And just remembering that, and don't, worst thing you can do is after hard sessions, if they don't go well, is beat yourself up over it, because that's when you kind of start to get on a road to not enjoying it, not enjoying the sport. And yeah, that's when life gets tough.
No, those are really great points. And I think I was going to ask if you could describe your overarching coaching philosophy, but I think we've touched on lots of points already that would play into that for sure. So maybe we go a bit more specific if we talk about training itself. And again, with all the things we discussed earlier, it is individual and so on. But do you have any general things that you could point out to in how you tend to program and prescribe training, maybe in terms of volume and intensity and so on, at least kind of starting points for then branching out into experiments from?
Yeah, I mean, it's still all kind of, you know, individual differences. There's not a set formula that I apply to anyone as such. So the one thing I will say in terms of philosophy, like, just, I do place a real importance on working on your limiting factor. So you mentioned it earlier in terms of if you're running in the top 25% aisle, biking in the top 25% aisle, but you're swimming in the bottom 75% aisle, then okay, I understand that swim's the hard one to work on. It's hard to take loads of time from it. But if that is the thing that is limiting you, then that's the thing that you potentially need to work on. And I'm very big on what is the thing that's stopping you from being successful. When you make this list, it's easy to describe in cycling terms. So the way I describe it with cycling is, if you are a sprinter, if you can do 1600, 1700 watts, but you can't get to the end of the race to use those watts, which is me all over, then there's no point working on your sprint even more. People always say to me, or assume to me, oh, you must do loads of sprint work. I'm like, no, I don't do any sprint work. I've never been limited by my ability to sprint. I've won UCI point HC races in a sprint, but I can't win national series which are in theory a lower level race, but they're normally not. But it's because the issue is I can't get to the end of them to do my sprint. And so for me, I never work on sprinting, because all that would do is I'd win the Gruppetto sprint by even more, which is pointless. Like, so for me, it's always been a case of working on like the aerobic power threshold, climbing. I'm not a climber. I don't want to be a good climber. I'm not trying to be a good climber. I'm trying to do enough to get over a climb so I can then do my sprint. And like applying this kind of same idea, you know, if you're a cyclist or work on that thing that's limiting you and stopping you from being successful. That's what I've always placed. That's the philosophy I'd still say I'd place the most importance on, is what is your limiting factor? How do you isolate that? How do you improve that? And what can you do to get the most out of that? So you can then use your strengths. Because as I say, sprinting for 80th isn't important. I don't need to improve that. And then in terms of like individual athletes, what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. I think I don't want volume is definitely one that can be important. I do always actually see that as being something that if people can get a bit more volume in, full stop, not all the time, not so it's ruining your marriage, not so you're losing sleep over it, but let's say you have, your teacher, like say, like, I have a few teachers or coaches, when they have half term, we'll set them a bit more volume. That does tend to work well. I do think around Christmas time, people doing the festive 500, I think if you can only afford 6 to 7 to 8 hours a week normally, and you do get that opportunity to do 12 hours, 13 hours on the odd week, I do think there's a, I think athletes do find a benefit in that quite often. But you know, you can only do as much as you can recover from. And that's what people forget. And you will have some listeners to this podcast who are like super intense, super like, you know, people that can train a lot. They have a wife, they have kids, they have everything else. They've got all these additional stresses. But they can try and fit in these 18 hours a week or 15 hours a week, like even with everything else, they just love training. The thing they have to consider is you also have to be able to recover from whatever you're doing. And they get to this point that, especially for, you know, your average person with jobs and with other stresses, is that for the more, any extra training you do, you can't just find an extra 2 hours a week. You have to find the extra energy in the week to be able to recover from those extra 2 hours you do as well. So that's definitely something that people need to remember and factor in. It's not just a case of more time is better or more intensity is better. It's more time and intensity that you can definitely recover and adapt from. That's just a super important part of it as well. While applying any experiment of should I do more intervals or more time or more anything, is can you afford to recover from it and adapt from it? And again, is that what limits you? Is the reason you're not improving not because you're not training hard enough? Is it because you're not recovering enough? Which for some people it often will be. If you're not sleeping enough, then it's almost pointless doing more hours. So you could, like, everyone could, if they wanted to, wake up an hour and a half earlier and do an hour before work every day. That is physically possible. There is time for everyone to do that, but it just wouldn't work because it would just be the additional stress and it just wouldn't gain from it, if that makes sense. So it's always a case for anyone that's like listening to this, that's not a pro athlete, anything you're doing has to be balanced with the recovery and adaptation phase. And just remembering that you've got that balance.
Yeah. I think another thing that people can consider related to that as well is that your athletic age, so how long have you been training for triathlon or cycling? And I think a lot of course, there are plenty of people that have been doing this for 10, 20, 30 years. But also there is a very, very large chunk of people that maybe are in there. They're already quite advanced, perhaps, because they have been doing good training for 4 or 5 years. But 4 or 5 years in endurance sports is still a fairly short time, and you probably have at least another 4 or 5 years of improvement in you, even if you're 45 or 50 years old, potentially. I mean, everybody's individual, but that's what I've seen, that you can still keep improving even at 50 if you're still only 5 years into the sport. So I think that it's not about... I think an important consideration there is that you just have to... be a bit patient and not try to do too much in an attempt to improve a lot very quickly, but do the right amount so that you keep improving slowly but slowly, as Eliud Kipchoge would say, and then you can keep gaining performance over all of those, let's say, first 10 years in endurance sports that you have. So I think that patience aspect is something that quite often gets lost. And it's also difficult for us as coaches, because athletes come to us and they should expect to see performance benefits from having a coach, of course. But it's a fine balance again there between, okay, how much do you focus on short-term performance versus just doing the right amount so that you get some performance gains, but you also can sustain that over a long period of time.
Yeah, 100%. I think this, for most people, this is the point that after you've been training 4 or 5 years of training well, like, you know, you are going to start to, like, not fully plateau, but the improvement, you know, you're not going to get easy improvements. You're not going to see your threshold improving 20 watts each year anymore. And that's when it gets hard, because you're still putting the same work you were in, in your second year or third year, and you don't get the same rewards for it, and it's tough. This is the point that a lot of people struggle and go, you know, they'll have that kind of first 2 to 5 years of being really up for it. And then that's where it kind of starts to drop off a little bit, and they either take a break from it or they sit back a little bit or they say, decide they've done what they've done. But this is, and it's because it's that patience, and it's, I get it. It's hard. Like I've just said, like, I've had the same thing. Like I've just gone through years of not seeing improvements, and it's really tough. And then it's been really nice going and swimming and running and seeing these improvements. Like that's what we all, so, it, but it, yeah, you do need that patience to just kind of keep going. And that's maybe where it is a case of making sure you have that enjoyment to be consistent. Because the only way to do it is to still keep being consistent. You don't just start suddenly hammering things and risk getting injured. But you have to accept that, yeah, you're going to get to a point that you have to fight a lot harder to get those 5 watts improvement. And whereas before, you just had to turn up and you'd get 20 watts improvement a year. And that 100%, this is the hardest part. And then this is, but equally, that's the part that you need to just have that patience, have confidence in yourself, your coach, your plan, your goals, and kind of take it from there and just, like maybe need to like rein it back a little bit and be realistic and say, I can't improve as much as I used to, but you are still, you've still got to work and try and improve. As long as you're doing that, then that's kind of all that as coaches, we can kind of ask for, that you've still got a growth mindset. That sounds really cheesy, but you're still trying to improve yourself and just having to accept that those little bits you're working for now aren't going to give you the same rewards you got before. But the only way to improve is to keep taking those little steps forward and to go with it that way.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that I think would be really interesting to discuss, again, piggybacking a bit off our discussion on the Sub-7 project, is fatigue resistance. And I mean, that's one of those things I think that, that's one of those things I think that is improving year over year as you get more experienced in endurance sports, even when you stop seeing your threshold go up or your VO2 max go up, then that fatigue resistance can still be improving, which leads to better race performance, depending on what your modality is, of course. But what's your view on fatigue resistance and how important it is and how to develop it?
Yes, there's been some really good studies that show the difference between the top under 23 pros and senior pros, and actually show that the 20-minute power or the threshold of watts per kilo over like those short distance or relatively short distances, no, 20 minutes isn't that short, well, maybe to triathletes it is, to me it's not, is that there's not much of a difference between those two athletes and those two different groups when they're fresh. The difference between the current World Tour pros and the developing under 23 is the fact that they can do it after 3,000 kilojoules, 4,000 kilojoules, whatever it is. Like that's what really starts to set the pro riders apart. It's not doing 6 watts per kilo normally. It's doing 6 watts per kilo at the end of a Tour de France stage, 2 weeks into a race. That's what separates the best from the rest. And it is that fatigue resistance. Obviously, part of that does come with age. You know, there's studies, like pretty old studies that have been out for a long time now, just showing the difference in pros comes from increased efficiency. The Paula Ratcliffe studies from back in the day were, they showed that Paula's VO2 max didn't really improve much after early 20s. And what it was that her economy and efficiency, that's what improved all the way through up to her breaking marathon world records. And these are some of the things that, again, it's really hard for athletes to measure, which makes it difficult to kind of keep your head on when training's not going well. Because if you're, let's say you're just doing 20-minute power tests, let's say that's the modality your coach has chosen to set you power tests, that it will get to a point where that won't keep improving. But that doesn't mean that you're not improving the things that are making you better at triathlon. Like, because again, it's about, you know, how, you know, triathlon is, this is why Joe Skipper's so good. He's not the best 10K runner or fresh half marathon runner in the world. He's just amazing at just running a marathon at the end of an Ironman. That is what makes Joe Skipper good. He's good at running while fatigued. That's what makes him special. And again, if you'd be successful, the chances are that's what you need. You need to be running as well as you can while tired at the end of an event. It's not about how well you run just a park run or how well you do a 20-minute test when you're fresh. It's about how well you do it when you're fatigued. Now, these are super hard to measure, like other than in races, you know, that, you can do this with athletes. I do see this done, but it's quite messy, so I don't do much of it myself. Is you might set like a 5-minute power test at the start of a ride, do a 3-hour ride at, you know, middle of zone 2, upper zone 2, and then do another 5-minute test at the end. Look at the drop off, and then in theory, through more training, you do the test again. And ideally, that 5-minute drop off at the end isn't the same percentage. You know, you've dropped off less, and that shows you've got an increased fatigue resistance. That's one way that I've seen a few pro teams and a few pro athletes working on measuring this. But that's not easy, and it's super messy, because obviously we all know what like a 3-hour ride can be. You can have cows run out in front of you, you'd have to stop for 10 minutes or just punches, and yeah, it would kind of ruin it all. It's quite hard to control, you know, temperature, do you drink enough, do you eat enough, blah, blah, blah. So it can get quite messy that way. But then in terms of how do you improve it, it's like, again, there's not really right or wrongs. I do think muscular strength is pretty important, and actually making sure your muscle is conditioned to that, especially for aging athletes. I think gym is really important. And I think, yes, strength is never a weakness, is a little expression. But yeah, I do think strength training is good for fatigue resistance, some overgeared work. And, you know, like I am a fan of a long ride. Like I don't feel the need to be, like, everyone doesn't need to crush volume on the week. This is a bit the opposite of what I've been saying, because I told someone the other day that, mate, while we're getting your consistency back, if you just need to ride 20 minutes on a night just to start being consistent again and just trying to get back in the flow of things and enjoying it, just do 20 minutes, that's fine. But I do have a real love for, just on a Sunday, which is the day for most people, maybe a Saturday for some others, I do like getting that one long ride in. I do personally think that is really advantageous. I've seen some coaches suggest that it's not needed for, because, you know, like in cyclists anyway, you go, oh, you only race for 2 hours, so you don't need to do a long ride. But for me, I think that's a really good way of increasing that fatigue resistance across anything, you know, even a 25-mile time trial, if you've got that more fatigue resistant. I do think those super long rides, they do help that. It's, and in terms of like what is a long ride for you, I think that's a case of how long can you go without kind of being absolutely boxed, you know, your heart rate going out of control, and remembering you need to train well the next week. So for me, that's like quite normally five hours. I'll occasionally take up to a 6 hour ride for me, but I can do that and normally still train on a Tuesday, because again, I've been give or take a pro for 10 years. Your average person, if they do 6 hours on a Sunday, is going to be boxed until Thursday. So that kind of defeats the point. So it's kind of building that up as long as you can go.
What do you see that the average person does? Is it 3 hours or four hours or two and a half hours?
I think three to three and a half is quite manageable if you do everything else right. So you need to fuel properly. If you do 3 hours and if you do 3.5 hours grippy and you only have 2 Mars bars and a bit of water, then yeah, you'll feel boxed from that and that won't be very helpful. The long ride is also a great opportunity to practice race day nutrition. So I did a 7 hour ride of the day, first time I've done one of these in years. But to make sure the last 2 hours weren't horrific, I just did full race day nutrition to practice it. So I did 100 grams an hour for the full ride, which does mean literally having like, I've almost got panniers on my bike to make sure there's enough fuel for me, kind of thing. It's a lot to carry. It's not easy. But if you're fully prepared to do that, then actually it's a really good way to practice your race nutrition, because I mentioned it earlier that the guys had done 100 grams per hour in the sub-7 attempt. And I actually heard that some of the pro athletes were doing actually quite a good chunk more than that. But you can't do that off the bat. That's something you have to train as well. You train, like, this is a completely different study, a completely different tangent, but you have to train that. So actually, if you are going to be doing some long, you know, three and a half, four hour, we're going to do some 5 hour rides, I think there's a place for them if you can recover. But one thing that will really help that is if you do fuel properly for them. So you are taking on 60 to 90 grams of carbs an hour, like experiment with more towards the end. Like, don't do this off the bat. If you've never done this before, don't try and do 5 hours at 100 grams an hour, because you'll feel terrible off it. But build yourself up to it. You know, like, there could just be like one of the hours in that 4 hour ride could be 100 grams and the rest could be like 60 grams. Build yourself up to it. But I got a lot of feedback from athletes that actually when I do long rides fully fueled, it's an absolute game changer. And it was for me when we first ever started doing this like 4 years ago. I think we were sponsored by one of the first nutrition companies that went in with this super high carb mix. That was the biggest thing. It made me realize that actually a lot of when you feel naff at the end of a 4 or 5 hour ride, it's not actually muscle damage. A lot of it is just the fact that you have just not eaten enough and you are just so depleted. I wouldn't do this for every ride, but yeah, if you're going to do some longer rides, there's double whammy here. You'll increase your fatigue resistance. You're getting yourself mentally prepared to be able to do exercise for 5 hours, because that's how long, you know, your half Ironman may be, or, you know, at least a good chunk towards how long an Ironman is. And you can then practice your actual fueling and practice like doing it, like getting this mass amount of carbs in, because there's one thing practicing 100 grams an hour for 1 hour there's another thing practicing 100 grams of carbs an hour for 4 hours. It's like it's a lot of food to take on, and that itself takes a lot of training. You can't just do that. Do not just suddenly decide to do that in training one day. Build yourself up and see what works for you and how much you can take on before you start to potentially get issues and start to have a few kind of setbacks with that.
Yeah, no, great. And just a quick follow-up. You mentioned in passing doing overgear work a bit for fatigue resistance. So what would an overgear session look like for you, or what would you typically prescribe there?
So there's a lot of debate around this. There's like this, and there's a few ways of doing it, and a lot of the people's ideas kind of can conflict with each other. Again, I actually, a little bit of this, there's not a right or wrong answer. So I do leave this up to athletes to select. I play with a few different ways of doing this, and I do see which athletes report back as to what works best for them. So initially I like actually super high torque. So 30 second, I kind of do as a bit of a preliminary, like almost gym workout on the bike. So 30 seconds, huge gear, all out. That takes a bit, that's in place of gym. If you kind of don't have access to gym, that requires building up to and being safe doing that. That's not a session that if you've never done that before, you can put your back out, you can pull your handlebars, you need to be careful doing that. But that's max, like real maximal kind of muscle recruitment. That's one I do like to kind of set, again, kind of with people that can't access gym so much. The other ones I then like to do are kind of building 2 to 5 minutes, like 50 RPM, upper zone 4, like as high as you can go. Again, really pressing the pedals for that amount of time. But again, it needs to be like 50 RPM is that super low cadence that feels. 50 is a lot worse than 70. These things do need to feel, in my opinion anyway, they need to feel relatively maximal when doing this. It can't be just completely chill. Like you can't. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the completely chill way of doing it. I do feel that anything muscular, you need to be really stressing the muscles to get that adaptation. You do that through the sessions being super hard or super long. And then the other way of doing it, and again, I know this is what a lot of other coaches do, so I'm not opposed to this, is they actually do a load of time, say like in kind of zone 3 sub-threshold, do sub-threshold over gear. I know like Sebastian Webb is a fan of this. And the idea of this, from my understanding, is that you're working in a torque that's above threshold. It's like above threshold torque, if that makes sense. So because you're doing it at 70 RPM, but say middle of zone 3, it's the same push on the pedals as if you were like upper zone 4, above threshold zone 5. But you're still working in a really aerobic way because you're just in the middle of, as I say, zone 3. This is like zone 3 in a 5-zone model. So zone 2 on a kind of between, below lactate 2, basically, or lactate turn point, or whatever the million things you want to call it are. Working below that point, but at a big cadence. So you're breathing, your aerobic system is fully aerobic. You're not kind of building lactate, but your muscles, you're stressing them out as if you're at a much higher power. In theory, you're then recruiting your fast twitch muscle fibers and these, but in a super aerobic environment. You're not kind of recruiting them when all hell's breaking loose and you're above that second break point and always going peak tong. You're in like a nice chilled environment. That's their kind of rationale on it. For some people, I've seen that's worked really well. I know that's what Sebastian Webber says. Tony works really well with like Tony Martin and stuff, and what he's done with him before. I know a few triathlon coaches that set that. That's not what I set all the time, but I do know it works well for some people. I'll play with it, and different people have this different response, and I think you have to be prepared to play with that. And I have some athletes that say this work, I tangibly feel the gains from that session. So if they do, then we roll with it and we maximize it and we get the most out of it. And again, like going back to all these different points that I keep reiterating, like an athlete's got to have a lot of belief in what they're doing. And if they physically go, I feel the gains from that, then that's telling me they've got a lot of belief in it, and that would definitely help them adapt. If an athlete doing a session that they do not believe in, they do not want to be doing it, they think it's pointless, then they won't adapt. Like it sounds stupid, but you can almost choose to not adapt from sessions, from what I've seen. And from what I've done myself, I know the sessions where I've gone, that's rubbish, and yeah, guess what? I didn't adapt from it. It's especially a case of a lot of, not a lot of athletes, but obviously we're a lot more aware of mental health at the moment and kind of depression and those kind of things. And that's this, again, I've gone well off a tangent here, but I do find, like, I'm not saying I'm depressed, I'm not saying that, but everyone, I think a lot of us have the, we go through times in lives that we just feel a bit down or a bit sad, like I say, at the passing of a mate last year or whatever. I think when you're in that mode, it's really hard to kind of get adaptation. I did it last year. And I was in a bit of a bad place. I was annoyed that COVID had kind of ruined my year again after I'd spent all year in Spain. I couldn't get my head into the idea that racing was going to happen again. I'd got really down about it. And I was still training. I was still doing like 13 hours ticking over, but in my head, I'd kind of checked out. So I was training, I was pushing the numbers, I was doing hard, but in my head, I'd checked out this idea that I'm not going to race. This training doesn't matter because racing's not going to happen. COVID's got in the way again. This is rubbish, blah, blah, blah. I was just in a bad place with it. And I went like crap. Like I went on team camp and I was so bad. Like I piled weight. I put like 3 kilos on after eating the same as I'd always eaten. And like my power dropped off an absolute cliff. Even though I was doing the exact same stimulus, I'd done loads of times and not lost any fitness off. If anything, I'd gained fitness off doing the same training. But I was in a mental place before that I adapted from it. And this time I was in a mental place where I didn't adapt from it. And I genuinely the power of the brain, I think, is pretty strong in that sense. And I think if someone's doing an overgeared session they feel works for them and they feel real gains from it, I think you can almost force yourself to create these gains and get the stimulus. I think if you're in a strength session that you feel is rubbish and just hurts your knees, then I think you can choose to almost not adapt from that session as well. So there's a definite, athletes have to believe in what they're doing. And I think that's where communication between coaches is also important, because if you know there's a session that definitely works for athletes, then you have to kind of sell the dream of this is a session that works. This is why it's doing this, 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 and this, and get the belief. And if you can't do that, then you've kind of, it's almost not worth setting the session, because if an athlete doesn't want to do it, even if they do, they won't be fully switched on to it and they just won't get the same gains, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, no, I think you make a great point there. And I've seen the same thing, that there are different coaches and athletes have done anything from long 20, 30 minute zone 3 interval set at a relatively high torque compared to the 30 second all out torque and everything in between, obviously. And you see successful coaches and athletes doing all of them. So who's to say if there is an ideal one or optimal one? It makes sense that, yes, you experiment a bit with the athlete, or what the athlete feels works the best for them. Like, that sounds like a good approach to me, because I don't know that anybody can say with any certainty that this way of doing it is definitely better than another. I don't think that the evidence for that exists. And then we talked about volume a bit already. What about intensity? How do you factor intensity into your coaching?
As a coach at the moment with podcasts and journals, and it's an app and polarized versus non-polarized, and it's a nightmare. Like it's really hard to like be like, so am I right? Am I wrong? Have I been setting training wrong all along? Because it's not the same as this. If you're a listener listening to this and thinking, I get properly confused by this, as a coach it's even worse, because we read even more on it and have even more opposing views on what you should or shouldn't be doing. I would say as a basis, I'm probably looking at kind of 2 interval sessions a week. The rest mostly volume is a bog standard kind of, you know, you've got 5 days a week that you're training. You could do intervals Tuesday, intervals Thursday, easy Wednesday, then like longer stuff on a kind of Saturday, Sunday. Maybe I'll make the Saturday in when I'm in race season. That will then be intervals. When it's in the weekend, it will just like in the winter, it then may just still be a long ride. That's like a completely basic, like the top of my head, kind of how a week may look. That's maybe what I'll start with, and then obviously we'll go from there as to what do athletes need. Some respond well off 3 hard sessions a week, some off 2 hard sessions a week, some off, you know, like, again, it depends where you want to sit on your kind of polarized debate. You know, like I do think there's a place for that changing as well, and not being super strict on whatever you think. Like it's too easy to have this blueprint of this is what works and it doesn't. You know, it may be a place of pyramidal works well for a bit, then polarized works well for a bit, and then come race week we actually just smash load of back-to-back intervals just to like really fine tune you up. Or, you know, like there's different things that work for different people. I think just being prepared to play with that and being prepared to have that scientific mind is really important. As a basis, as a starting point, yeah, 2 hard sessions a week is probably not a bad point to go from. And then kind of go from there. And it might be that your 3rd session a week is then in that middle zone. So you might do your 2 hard sessions are kind of, you know, that hard above above, you know, above what I call something happens to, rather than joining with the debate of whether you call it MLS or VT2 or, yeah, all the different names that are a pain in the ass. Even though all those names aren't the same thing, Critical Power is the one I actually use personally. But, yeah, so I'll do sessions above or stimulating kind of above that for the, you know, maybe the two sessions a week, and you might choose the Saturday is then that sort of threshold stuff or that, you know, in that kind of lactate clearance. And then you might maybe choose that's when you're going to do your overgeared stuff. But, you know, like it's, again, it's like tempo training is a great example of some athletes love it, some athletes hate it. Like I've always been quite a big proponent of it's a gray zone, and I'm not a massive fan of putting stuff there. I think once you get to about 90% of threshold or CP, then you're kind of looking at lactate clearance. I think it becomes of use again. But I think for me, the middle of tempo, I don't put much in that zone there. But for some people, that works really well. I know, like some, like it was, you know, these people that read lots of research, are super scientific, and they love that. Like I know that, yeah. So I know world tour riders spend a lot of time there. They're not always the best people to copy with stuff, for various reasons. But yeah, it does depend on you and being prepared to play with a week that works best for how you seem to adapt, how you seem to respond, and being prepared to change that and play with that. And if you want to put in a polarized approach, great. But it can be changed. It can be moved. Like, you know, I met Stephen out in Norway when we were working with Uno X, and like he's still like, you know, it's not, you know, on a podcast and stuff, he obviously has to be, you know, like, you know, this is, he explains it in like, you know, a really good way. And he's, you know, he's brilliant to listen to on these things. But obviously, like, he's still fully aware there's caveats, and it's not a golden rule. It's not, this has to be, like, even if you do decide I'm polarized, that's the approach I'm taking, I'm this 80-20 approach, he's still fully aware that's not set in stone. That's not absolute gospel. If you suddenly do 1 week where you do three sessions, the whole year's gone to pot. Like, you know, there's times and places for everything. And, you know, he's more than a smart enough bloke. He's fully aware of that. Like, you know, everyone's aware there's caveats to all these different things and all these different approaches, and try to not get so in the weeds of why you should be doing exactly this one specific type of training. I think that's quite important to have that kind of approach, that it's not just one size fits all.
Yeah, absolutely. One variable that I think is quite important there is, well, how much time does the athlete have to train? So if you have an athlete that has 2 hours to do on the Tuesday and the Thursday when you set the intervals, then you have plenty of room to play with that session to add tempo and threshold work and make it an effective session. But if they only have 1 hour, then you're kind of constrained by that. And then maybe it makes more sense to have more high intensity intervals there, because you might not be able to get in enough of that tempo work or threshold work to make it quite as effective. So it's not necessarily that one approach is better than another. It's, yeah, there are so many factors, and that time example is just one of many variables to consider.
Yeah, I think we and I as coaches, we forget that, you know, some people can be super serious about their sport. They could be listening to this podcast and they love triathlon and they love the training behind it, but they might only have 30 minutes. And in which case, if you only have 30 minutes, then like there's a place for just smashing out that 30 minutes and just getting some Tabata intervals in or a Zwift race in. And, you know, if that's all you've got, you know, a few times a week, and then you can just get your longer ride in. You have to still make what works best for you. And it's definitely something that I probably get not carried away with, but if someone presents me with the opportunity to set them an hour and a half after work, then I'll take it. Like, yeah, great. That's perfect if you can do that. But that's not everyone. And yeah, and it's only perfect if you can fit it in with your life and recover from it and still take the dog a walk. It's not perfect. It's not perfect if that's really stressful to squeeze that in. And there's people that can only do half an hour and, or 20 minutes. If that's all you can do, that's all you can do. If you've got 20 minutes on your work hour, and that's all that you can fit in, then just you shouldn't be trying to train the exact way the Kenyan trains or Alistair Brownlee trains. If you've got 20 minute windows, you know, it should be a bit different. It should be, and there's not, you know, there's not loads of studies on the effects of someone that's got 20 minutes to train a day. So because the studies aren't there, then you just do the study yourself. You do the effects of what is the best training for Joe Bloggs, like during the winter when he's got, and that's all he's got. And I say, just keep applying that mindset that you're applying these different stimulus. And it's not easy, because again, another great saying is you're never walking into the same stream twice. And, you know, what may work one time, you know, an 8 week block of Tabata intervals may work great the first time you do it, and the second time it may be completely different because you'd already done a a high intensity block before it, or you'd done a tempo block before it, or whatever it was. So it's a constant minefield, and don't think that anybody out there knows the exact right thing to be doing for anybody, because they don't. I think that's also a massive part of it. There's, you listen to all these experts and read all these books, and you're just like, it can be a minefield of thinking, like, what is the right thing to be doing then? And the answer is no one knows. No one, there is not, if that was a magic formula out there, someone would just sell it, and then we'd all do the same training, and they'd be making millions, and everyone else would be out of a job. No one knows what they're doing. Like, it's always a case of applying, like, you know, the best thinking that with the science that is the current, like, you know, the current approach or the current consensus, applying that and trying to work it for you. But that can change. You know, like we see science changes. It's not fixed. Science is only ever, I think they got this off the show when someone said it's just the best accepted view at the time of whatever we believe. And you're just applying that to you the best you can.
Yeah, exactly. And we are getting towards the end of the interview. I'm just going to ask you one more question before the rapid fire ones. And I already in my head decided that we'll split this interview into two episodes, just so we don't have a two and a half hour episode or a 2 hour episode. But anyway, I do want to touch on the role of the coach athlete relationship. And what's your thoughts on that as a coach? How do you develop a good coach athlete relationship? What is the relevance and importance of that?
Yeah, so a massive part of this is just empathy. And I think that is ultimately where any coach that's got a bit more experience in sport or has spent years in sport or has spent years failing in sport one way or another, like, I think it can really help. It's common, you know, the best athletes don't always make the best coaches, because the best athletes, the ones that just whatever they do, they respond, they go to races, they win races, they don't get setbacks or they don't have many setbacks. Whereas, yeah, I've been dropped in a lot more races than races I've won. I think it really helps to understand that, to understand when an athlete is feeling down and not happy or not enjoying it and has been spat at the Sunday race, that you've been there, you've done that. You don't just suddenly go, oh, but did you do all your intervals this week? Did you do your openers properly? Well, how was your warm up? Actually understanding where their mental state is at the time and saying, you know, like, okay, I understand where you're at. I know this is crap. We're going to just relax tonight, you know, chill, go back, have a glass of wine, or just, you know, because I've been there. So it's easy to empathize when you've been in the same experience. I've driven 4 hours up to a race, got spat in the first 10K, driven back, had a Burger King, then felt like an even worse person because not only have I been spat, I've also had a Burger King that I shouldn't have had. And your head's going and you're like, oh, I'm such an awful athlete. I'm an awful human being. And understanding that that's, you know, the athletes are emotional athletes. That's the way they are. You know, they're men, female, like, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, we have this emotion. We all put so much into this sport. It's not an easy sport. It's not like, I mean, no sport's easy, but we do know there's team sports where you can turn up to your training session on a midweek and then you play your game on your Sunday. And if the game goes badly, well, there's 11 of you to blame or 15 of you to blame, whichever sport you're playing. Whereas, you know, triathlon is, you know, you can spend hours a week, you know, hours a month, like, has this big financial potential cost on you. And then you go to a race and you can go bad. It happens, and it's rubbish. And it's an awful situation to be in. And I think making sure you're there for the bad stuff and really can help athletes get through that and have that empathy with athletes. Because I think that's, yeah, dealing with the lows is almost more important than dealing with the highs in sport, because there's, in our sport, and endurance sport, there's more lows than there are highs. There's a lot of times that even if sessions go well, they're so tough. And there's times that people are tired in the week. And yeah, I think making sure you can really understand those bad points, because if you can get through those points, that's when you'll be successful. It's like as we said earlier in the podcast, it's not all sunshine and daisies. It won't all be sunshine and daisies. You're going to have to go through sessions that are bad. You're going to have to go through sessions that failed. You're going to do power tests that you've done less power than you did last time and you can't figure out why. And it's riding those waves out. And I think as a coach, making sure you understand that and you're not just treating these athletes as robots. And, you know, there's certain people on Twitter that kind of preach their views to athletes as if the athletes are robots. Oh, like, why aren't all the athletes need to do is be consistent. Just be consistent. It's easy. And it's like, we know consistency is important, but we also know it's really hard because we have a lot of things going on in our lives. You know, like Western society it's intense at the moment. Like, it's maybe too intense. You know, if you live in inner city, I don't know how people can live in these inner cities and train and keep their lives together. Like, I have huge respect for them. It's baffling to me how they can even do it and manage it. You know, just telling that person, oh, just be consistent. I was like, oh, yeah, great. They know that. Like, oh, just eat properly during the day. And it's like, yeah, they know that, but they haven't got time to make a Caesar salad. You know, like, they are going to have to go to Tesco for lunch or, you know, have a sandwich at times. Yeah. You should be working on, how do you facilitate that? How do you make that better? But you have to understand why they're currently doing whatever they're doing, educate them, and try and work out a best way of kind of prioritizing and improving, like, whatever situation they're doing. Try and work out how they can improve their sleep, try and improve how they can work the training, whatever it is, you know, helping them as much as possible, but also understanding why they're kind of where they're currently at. And not just, you know, we all know how to eat healthy. We all know we should be sleeping 8 hours a week. We all know what training we should be doing. Like, to an extent, it's, you know, a lot of it's, how do you work on facilitating that when, you know, when there's a lot of barriers in the way, and there's a lot of, you know, and trying to really understand how an athlete's got to where they're at with whatever it is. And just, you're just on a constant path of progression. It's not a, you should be doing this, why aren't you doing that? That's wrong. And just, yeah, it's about how you're leading as a coach. All you're trying to do is facilitate that person being successful, but it's there, you know, you're just giving them the tools to do it themselves, teaching them to use the tools. It shouldn't be a dictatorship of, you do this, you do that, you do the other. Like, it's a kind of, you're just helping guide them and give them the tools and educate them to what, to how to do that, so they can be successful themselves.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. It's all so true. The only thing I can add to that really is, I think one thing that I also see as important is just reassuring the athlete that, yeah, when things are not perfect, they're not the only one. For everybody else, it's the exact same thing. Maybe if you're the absolute best in the world, things can at some point be pretty perfect, but for most people, even at a very high level, things come up, things go wrong, they have bad days, bad weeks, bad months, bad races, and they stop to eat at Burger King, and they sleep poorly, get 3 hours of sleep, and need to go out and do a session, or need to skip the session, whatever it may be. It's not that, reassuring the athlete that they're not, it's nothing uncommon, and it does happen. And yeah, just moving on and being okay with it, I think is really important on that note.
Yeah, just that we're all human. We're not, yeah, and just to be super, super aware of that. And I think it's just really, really important.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one final question before the rapid fire questions. If you can give 1 to 3 pieces of advice for the listeners, anything related to improving their performance, what would that be?
Oh, that covered so much stuff. Okay. I'll reiterate some of the stuff I said earlier. I love the idea of, you finish a race and you have this, what can I do differently? And try and work that out. I think that's super important. I actually think it's fun to do, to actually sit there and what can I do? You have to be realistic. It's not just, you can't just write, I'm going to ride 50 watts harder next time. Like, it has to be realistic, but anything you can do to kind of help improve your performance, I just think it's great to just be on that path of improvement, however it can be. Because as I say, there's times that training's tough, so at least you can get a quicker tire. is one thing you can do. And then I think another one's probably that scientific mindset, just in general, is that, you know, you're trying to do, you know, you're trying to do the best that, you know, you're trying to apply logic and science the best that you can, but for you, for that given circumstance, on that moment in time, in place. You know, it's not a one size fits all. It's the best science to be applied for you as an individual, not just for, like, yeah, just not just full stop. I'm trying to think of the third one now. There's like so many things I've kind of touched on. And this is definitely a more recent one for myself, because I did it, and just really trying to not beat yourself up and kind of stay in that positive mindset the best you can. which again isn't easy. Like, it's I'm not saying, oh, just choose to be happy. Like, you can't just choose to be happy and loving every session. It'd be great if we all could, but you can't. But so just try and control that the best you can. Like, honestly, I had like one of the best races I did in the last 3 years probably was a mountain bike race that someone just put on the group chat. There's a mountain bike race around the local park later tonight. I just rocked up. I was, you know, I did it. I think I was okay. It wasn't a mountain bike. It was a cyclocross race. It's a cyclocross race in the summer. I hadn't even got a cyclocross bike to do it on a mountain bike. There we go. It's not even a mountain bike race. And it was just the local lads. And I just joined in and turned up on the night. I hadn't prepared for it. I hadn't trained for it. I loved it. I had so much fun because it was just, you know, I wasn't good. I was just racing the guys that do the local club run and the chain gang. You know, we had a real good battle, and we'd go through this sand pit every lap that I couldn't ride, and I'd unclip and like make a tit of myself, but I didn't care. So, you know, being prepared to do stuff that you want to do that kind of keeps you in that mindset and keeps you happy, I just think is, yeah, super. Like, when our sport is so hard, and, you know, when we haven't got these training groups, we haven't got our coaches necessarily running with us every time and shouting at us and giving us this positive feedback, that, you know, I do think we have to take it upon ourselves to try and make sure, you know, you're in a good place, you're happy. And if that's calf stops or whatever it is, you know, like if that helps you, then that helps you.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
So I'll just go for, at the moment, I'm on Skiba's new book. I'm just reading it now. Scientific Training for Endurance Athletes. Yeah, that's my current one. So I'll just go for that because there's too many other good ones to name otherwise.
Yeah, perfect. Phil Skiba, past episode of the podcast, so I'll link to that in the show notes. And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
When I can, getting into a good sleep routine is massively helpful. I'd be lying if I said that I do that all the time. I don't. I do have an unhealthy sleeping pattern at times, but when I get it right, then it does really help. And the absolute bonus would be if I could tie a nap into that, then I'm on for a real winner. But I can't do that very often anymore. But yeah, trying to work out that sleep routine, and then if you somehow can even a nap, which has been a while since I've tied that in, that can definitely be massively helpful, for at least for me anyway.
Yeah. And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I don't need to inflate his ego anymore, and I've already spoke about him a lot on this, but ultimately working with Dan is, as Dan Bigness is, has been, you know, it is good, because he, having other people that are just in your group chat that are kind of on a similar journey and path to you, of just constantly trying to improve things, constantly trying to make things better. And, you know, he goes out there and proves it, improves his theories, and that gives you confidence to go out there and improve your stuff, improve your theories. And it's, you know, it's that same thing you have with sport. If your training partner starts going really well, you tend to go really well because you have the confidence in what they're doing, and then gives you confidence in yourself. So I do think that with Dan, like, you know, in his book, we talk about us being a bit of a yin and yang. I'm a lot more, he says I'm negative compared to him. I say I'm pragmatic. But yeah, it's seeing the success he's had in sport and the influence that he's had now with Ineos. Yeah, it's been good. It has been useful for me to kind of, give myself confidence that that's the kind of journey and direction that I can also go on through sport. And there's not as many barriers holding us back as we maybe first believed.
Yeah. And Dan Bigham is another past guest of the podcast, so I'll link to that as well. And finally, Jacob, first of all, thank you so much for this fantastic chat. I really enjoyed it. And where can people find out more about you and learn more about you?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram and Twitter just under my name, Jacob Tipper. And my coaching website is Jacob Tipper JTPerformanceCoaching.com, I think. I didn't give it out very often.
I'll find it out.
It's there somewhere. If you Google it, I'm hoping it comes up. But maybe not.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much. It's been great to chat with you, and hope to do it again another time.
Yeah, great. Hopefully it wasn't too long for everyone. And thanks for listening.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. I'll link to all of Jacob's social media and website, of course, as well as to episodes and interviews I've done with Dan Bigham and Dr. Philip Skiba. And Philip Skiba has been on twice in episodes 311 and 173. While you're there, if you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or checking out our training plans. Whether you're just getting started or you're a pro-level athlete, just contact us. We would love to have a discussion and see if we can help you. Next Monday, we have Andy Blow from Precision Fuel and Hydration on the show to talk about the science and practice of using caffeine to enhance endurance performance. It's a great episode. The science is pretty clear and straightforward, but the application, especially in triathlon and other long endurance events, is a bit less so. So getting Andy on to talk about the practical aspects of it and what they see in data that they have collected with some of the world's best athletes is really, really fascinating. Big thanks finally to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and sunglasses and prescription glasses. And use the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your entire Roka order. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate Swim Trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and most importantly, your swim training consistency. And get 20% off your order on the Swim Trainer with the promo code that you can get on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. And don't forget that it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.